I'm Raymond Arroyo. Dissent from the authentic teachings of the Catholic Church has become epidemic. The teachings of the Pope and the Second Vatican Council have become a mere matter of conscience to some. Theologians have gone so far as to use the council documents to personally object to key church teachings. How did the church reach this point? What do the Vatican II documents really say? In this second installment of What Went Wrong with Vatican II, Dr. Ralph McInerney will answer those questions. He believes the epidemic of dissent and distortion can be traced back to a particular historic event in the church.
In 1968, which was just 2.5 years after the close of the council, in July 29th, Paul VI issued an encyclical letter called Humani Vitae, of Human Life. And in it, he did what he said he would do, and that is what John the 23rd had decided to do early on in the council, that is, reserve any decision about artificial contraception, take it off the council floor, and to have a commission that would study it and then come up with a resolution. John the 23rd died, Paul the 6th was elected, the advisors went on advising and so forth, and eventually he wrote this encyclical on human life. And in it he reaffirmed that there was no way in which, from the point of view of natural law, artificial contraception could be regarded as morally permissible. This was not a new thing. It was to say, as has always been thought and taught, this is the case. During the interval from the time that John the 23rd had removed this from the agenda of the council and had created a commission to advise him, the scuttlebutt was that there was going to be a change. Now, you have to remember that at this time there was a single pill, the estrogen pill. And the real question was, is this a contraceptive? Is this a contraceptive? Is the effect that it has on women who take it, is it contraceptive or is it something else? That's really what generated the thing in the first place. Do we have here a medicine that, in effect, controls birth, but not in a way that would count as contraception? So these were issues the Pope didn't want discussed on the council. This is too technical. You have to have experts in on it. And the commission that he appointed contained various kinds of experts. When he died, John the 23rd, what Paul the 6th did was to enlarge that consultative body. You see, time was going on here, year after year. They were meeting, and of course they were telling their friends what was going on and so forth. So the word came out that the commission tended in the direction of advising the Pope that that a change could be made in this doctrine. And they went beyond talking about the estrogen pill. They began to talk about contraception as such. And just said, this is nothing that we have to continue to prohibit and so forth. All that being the case, and one could go on about that intervening period, because it's very important to understand that for years a lot of people were told and thought that there was going to be a radical change in church teaching in this matter. They didn't invent it, they heard it. It was passed on, it was in the air, and so quite sincerely, they expected this to happen. A lot of people anticipated this result, as you can imagine they would, and it would no longer seem like a very serious thing if you were told up until Wednesday such and such is wrong, but after Wednesday, well, Tuesday, you're going to waver a bit as to how you're going to behave. So there was that, and the pastoral counseling on it began to say, well, you know, wait, something's going to happen. Well, why wait? And so it was a strange period, but there was a lot of actions and statements and deeds that went on there that I don't think anyone could say were wrong because of what people were being told, subjectively, certainly. They were anticipating this big thing. So that was the mood in all kinds of people, that the change is about to be announced, and then out comes the encyclical and says no.
What did that commission advise the Pope to do, and what was his reaction?
The commission, we're told, the majority of, well, we know because they leaked their report to the National Catholic Reporter and it was published there, the majority in the commission said that the doctrine should be changed because no one could any longer argue the traditional prohibition, the reasons for the traditional prohibition convincingly. Nobody thought those arguments worked anymore. That was the allegation. So they were saying there's no obstacle to this, go ahead and change it. So the majority of them apparently were of such a mind, and that was their advice. So it was not unreasonable to assume that he would follow this advice, which was given in good faith by and large. These weren't people who were interested in destroying the moral law and so forth. I mean, I think you have to, when you talk about these things, to think about them, you have to think contemporaneously as well as in retrospect. And in fairness to people, I knew a lot of people who reacted negatively to the to Humanae Vitae, and it was a carryover from this period just prior to the thing. Eventually they accepted the thing, but I could understand that reaction because the expectation had been there and it was not an unreasonable thing. And to be told that something you had expected and you'd been told was going to happen wasn't going to happen, it's quite understandable that people would have reacted the way that they did. But that was the explosion, and it was literally an explosion. It was a media event. People in this country theologians took out an ad in the New York Times the following day to express their non-acceptance of a papal encyclical. We are Catholic theologians, and we do not. This is unusual. It's newsworthy. They paid for the ad, but within no time, they had hundreds of people who were saying they agreed with this non-acceptance of the papal encyclical. Bishops, by and large around the world, held fast, but with varying degrees of clarity. There was a lot of waffling. But there were strange episodes. One Monsignor saying he was going to turn in his Monsignorial piping because he couldn't be a Monsignor under this Pope. There were some very comic sorts of reaction. And what was lost sight of was the document itself. The document itself could not have been read by the people who the following morning, before the thing was available to anybody, were taking out an ad and saying they didn't accept this. What they didn't accept was the dashing of their hopes. They did not know what that document was. It's one of the most beautiful statements of the nature of Christian marriage you could possibly read. It puts the relationships between man and woman on a plane that is just simply beautiful. It is countercultural, there's no doubt about that. But what the nub of the encyclical is that the procreative and the unitive meaning of the marital act cannot be separated. And if you separate the unitive meaning from the procreative meaning, you have in principle already accepted extramarital sex, premarital sex, homosexuality, the whole bit. And the Holy Father said this in the encyclical. At the time, many of those who rejected it and then went on to read it just dismissed this as silly to think, and they themselves, of course, were not then for any of these other things. They were quite, they meant we would never be for those things, so why would you think that in being for this we would be for all those things? But what he had put his finger on, and what the present Pope has always emphasized, is that once you separate those two meanings, you're never going to be able to get them back together again. Because what you're going to do is, in effect, it's the recreational aspect of sex, which is sort of self-justifying, and then you think of the procreative as a possible add-on. But what you're saying is that the pursuit of sexual activity for pleasure, and that could mean of a gross or of a more humane kind, that's self-justifying. Well, if that's the case, and if procreation has nothing to do with it, what does it matter whether the partner is male or female, your wife or the woman next door? Or, I mean, you cannot talk about something that involves us as deeply as this, as if you could separate off these things and have the one without the other.
In addition to the teaching, he also foresaw the long-term impact of using artificial contraceptive. Has history proven him right?
It's probably one of the most prescient or prophetic documents of recent papal document. See, this was in the 60s. We're talking the years of the sexual revolution. Here we expect the supreme religious teacher to be able to discern what's going on in the world and to say things about the behavior of Christians in such a world. And he was saying that this kind of behavior is going to lead down deeper and deeper down a slippery slope societally. And so it has. So it has. It's anyone who thinks that contraception is something that strengthens family life is reading the wrong newspapers. I mean, it's not the case. So you might lament this, or you might say it's just a strange statistical correlation, as say between smoking and lung cancer or something like that. But isn't that interesting that the two go hand in hand? No, they're clearly related. And it's more widely recognized, I think, now on all fronts. But here you had this Holy Father, Paul VI, in 1968, under the pressure of this commission, urging him, great expectation, and as if this was the spirit of the council, you see, to do this, guided by the Holy Spirit, no doubt about that. If he'd been guided by his own wishes, maybe he would have gone the other way. But he saw what the truth of the matter was. He taught the truth of the matter, that is the case, is more obvious to us today than it was at the time.
At this moment, the moment Humanae Vitae was released, theologians began to question the authority of a papal teaching. How did they do that?
Well, what they did was to begin, what theologians did when they rejected Humanae Vitae was to question whether or not a letter from a pope had this kind of binding thing. So you got the kinds of discussions that came up earlier in terms of degrees of bindingness, so to say, and is it infallible, and this kind of thing. So what they looked for was a little wiggle room whereby they could say, look, we're good Catholics. In fact, we're more Catholic than the Pope, but we don't accept this particular encyclical. And against one response after another that made that untenable, they've continued to say that. It has become, in recent times, totally untenable to think that you can accept or reject the teaching of Humanae Vitae. If anything is binding on Catholics, it is the content of that encyclical. And one, it seems to me, quite apart from being a Catholic and quite apart from one's confidence in the authority of the Holy Father, just looking at the world and looking at the contents of that encyclical, you'd say, this is the truth. This is the truth. And it is a truth of natural law, first of all. It's not a truth of religion, that this is what human beings are, and this is what is fulfilling of them, and this is what is not fulfilling of them.
Even though these theologians were talking about a papal teaching in this particular papal encyclical, what was the real focus of their dissent and their efforts?
Well, you can see that in rejecting a papal encyclical about X, or sex in this case, what you really are looking to is the formality under which the thing is being offered, that is the authority of the teaching church. And in rejecting this particular content, your target became increasingly the authority that was proposing such and such a doctrine. And indeed, that's what's happened. There began in 1968 what is now a tradition of dissent on the part of theologians. Theologians who routinely, when a magisterial document appears, can be counted on to reject it, to dismiss it, to say, you don't have to listen to that, it will be ignored. This is a favorite. No one will listen to this. And so anything but responding to it as a statement from the vicar of Christ on earth. It's a very strange thing. So you've had 30 years now of theologians as a group responding in this particular way.
How was that vision of theologians and their vision of what the role of the theologian different from Vatican II's vision of a theologian?
If you look in Vatican II documents for references to theologians, they're hard to come by. I mean, theologians don't loom that large in the documents of Vatican II. And probably because nobody thought of it as a problem. Nobody thought you had to define the role of theologians. Subsequently, we've had to do that. The church has had to do that. Cardinal Ratzinger a few years ago wrote a beautiful document, much ignored, called The Ecclesial Role of the Theologian, the role within the church of the theologian. And it seems to me the very title suggests something that is often absent. To be a theologian is to perform a function within the church. And that means it's a function vis-a-vis the magisterium, among other things. It's not a freelance role. It's not I'll make up my religion and you can compare it with the popes and see which one you like and so forth. No one talked about that at the time of the Vatican Council, what the role of the theologian was, because, again, as I say, no one thought that it would be a problem. But because of this history of dissent, this interposition of the theologian between the magisterium and people, which has skewed Vatican II, it's necessary to ask yourself, what is a theologian? What is a theologian? And it's a good question. Once upon a time in the Middle Ages, when the greatest theologians lived and wrote, they spent a lot of time defining what a theologian is, that is, what theology is, and so forth. And now it's difficult to know. I remember thinking that people who signed as theologians this document of dissent from Humanae Vitae, I hadn't realized that they were theologians before, and there was no reason to think they were in many cases. They just declared themselves to be theologians. Now, if being a theologian is simply calling yourself one, then that's one thing. But I think if you consider the role of the theologian in the church, certain characteristics immediately suggest themselves or you're reminded of them, and you're unlikely to think or to say that a theologian might or might not, might do such and such or might not do such and such.
How did the conception of these theologians, their view of the papacy, differ from Vatican II's view of the papacy?
Well, I think if you ask yourself how someone could adopt the stance of the dissenters from Vatican, Humanae Vitae, and read the documents of Vatican II, I've never understood how this is possible. It just seems to me that there's such an obvious conflict between the two that there's just no two ways about it. But believe me, people show a great deal of agility in maintaining the positions that philosophy has often been described as finding bad reasons for what you believe on instinct. Maybe theology is that too, that you already are committed to a certain position, so nothing is going to prevent you from retaining it, even a good argument against it.
Including Vatican II's documentation.
Vatican II.
Now, can one dissent or advocate disobedience within the church according to Vatican II?
Well, Vatican II did not talk about dissent. There was a document put out by the International Theological Commission on permissible dissent within the church. What we mean by dissent, what I mean by dissent that would lead me to say no one can dissent from the teachings of the Catholic Church and call himself a Catholic. What I mean by dissent there is open public denial and advocacy of the opposite position of what the church teaches, taking out ads in the New York Times, trying to lobby the faithful against the position of the magisterium, politicizing, in short, the whole thing. That, if that's what dissent means, and I'm afraid that's what it does mean, that's one thing. If by dissent One meant the time-honored way in which theologians always consider the pros and cons of anything that the church teaches, without necessarily adopting the con as their own view, but nonetheless reflecting on the rationale within the deposit of the faith or the analogy of the faith for this or that doctrine. That is theology. But that is not advocating rejection. This is not advocating denial and so forth. It's an effort, time-honored, noble effort of theology to penetrate ever more deeply into the mystery of the faith. I mean, it's hard sometimes to retain the notion that theology is the mistress, the queen of the sciences. It's the most noble intellectual discipline of all. And nothing that recent theologians have done should ever cause us to forget that. And when the church talks about theology, when the magisterial documents talk about theology, they're thinking of it in this exalted sense, when we think of St. Augustine and St. Thomas and St. Bonaventure and so forth, and Newman and other great ponderers of faith who were... In the course of doing that, we'll consider, well, what if someone would say this? What if someone would say that? You look at the great treatises on the Trinity. I mean, you'll find all the best arguments against the Trinity in the course of the treatise on the Trinity. But they're not there to undermine the faith, but rather to respond to what might seem to be difficulties for this mystery of the faith and so on. So that's not dissent, in other words. But yeah. Oftentimes people will... advocate or justify dissent in the first sense that I mentioned, and by invoking the second sense of dissent and say that's what theologians do. Theologians, as a rule, didn't take out ads in the New York Times before 1968.
Since this period we're discussing, we've heard a lot about follow your conscience in matters mm-hmm. of morality.
Yeah.
What does that mean, and what does Vatican, the council documents mm-hmm. yeah. say about that sort of thing?
Conscience is very often involved. For example, when people are given bad advice about the sexual morality of the church, they were told the official church teaches such and such, but follow your own conscience. Now that is, of course, an extraordinary notion of what conscience is. What a Catholic is held to do as a Catholic is to form his conscience in the light of the teaching of the church, not as an alternative to the teaching of the church. Very often what you get in implications of conscience is, I think, what I will call a very Protestant notion of conscience, which is a private between me and God. There's no one else involved in this, and I will decide here, and you can't tell whether what I'm doing is right or wrong and so forth. That's a very bizarre notion of what action is, because if somebody tells me that he's going to shoot my mother-in-law and that this is something his conscience tells him is all right to do, if I talk to him about it, we immediately are going to invoke common statements about what he's doing. Is it okay to take this gun and to shoot that human being who happens to be my mother-in-law? In other words, there's a common proposition in there somewhere. And what conscience is applying that to particular circumstances. It's not inventing a new morality here in the order of particularity which trumps the common thing. You have to justify the particular by invoking the common. Yeah? So it's a false opposition often.
Does Vatican II allow us to deny assent to certain types of papal teaching?
I've often thought that when we get into the question of wondering, well, what and how much and so forth, that what we ought to do is to ask ourselves, why are we asking that question? Because it's a bad question. It's asking ourselves, how little need I believe? How far can I go, let's say, without sinning and this kind of thing? That's always a dangerous kind of calculation to enter into. And when we're thinking about the faith, if we're robust in our faith and we're listening to the teaching church, we're not listening to some people in Rome talking. I mean, we're listening to the vicar of Christ on earth, St. Peter's successor, the bishop of Rome. He's just not the guy next door. So when you listen to him, you are attending to more than his words. And if you ask yourself, how much of this do I have to take in the light of that description of who you're listening to? It seems to me that the question answers itself.
The distinction I'm looking for is the difference between an opinion of the Pope and a teaching of the Pope. For instance, he supports this world court at the UN.
Yeah.
However, that should not be given the same weight as a teaching document. Can you speak a little to that distinction? Because they're often confused.
Yeah. Popes, of course, speak about lots of things and on lots of occasions. They give many addresses every week. And most of them find a way into print, and they give views and opinions on this or that, and without in any way engaging their papal authority. The example of, say, a world court, which people in this country, I think, are rightly very dubious about in terms of its practicality, would be a good example. We would want to see what the Holy Father has in mind, or what the Vatican has in mind, and thinking this is a good idea. But we might want to say, let's talk about that some more. And chances are they would be happy to talk about it. Another example now is capital punishment, where there's a clear disposition on the part of the Holy Father to see it as disappearing from sight. He's not said that, it's important to note, and nor has anyone else in a position of authority said that the Catholic Church no longer thinks that capital punishment is justified. But it's not surprising for people to think that the tendency is in the direction of saying that it's no longer justified. I don't think that day will come, but it's the sort of thing now that you could say the Pope thinks it will. He sure sounds as if he would. And therefore, do I have to sign on to that? Well, you wouldn't just dismiss that, but there are certain considerations that might lead you to say that it looks as if, however rare we would want it to be and how very cautiously and carefully we would want it applied, that the community has the right to exact capital punishment for certain crimes against itself.
Yeah. What has been, in your opinion, the long-term impact on the faithful of these battles between theologians and the Vatican?
Yeah, you wonder, do people really notice what's going on in these kind of rarefied battles between theologians and bishops and so forth? Fortunately, I think they're largely unaware of them. And of course, people ought to be unaware of theology even at its best. It's not the sort of thing that's meant to be grist for everybody's breakfast. But in this case, I think where you get a bad exercise of theology in cases that I've mentioned, it's not confined to theologians. I mean, it goes out into newspapers, it gets on television and so forth, and worse, it filters down into from universities to colleges, from colleges to high schools, from high schools into parishes, into marriage preparation courses and so forth, so that someone about to get married is likely to hear someone say, well, the official church teaching is this, and you make up your own mind. And so these dreadful mistakes come down and have an impact on people at crucial points in their life, and that's no joke. That's something for which I think theologians are going to have to answer.
Be sure to join Ralph McInerney and I for the third and final installment of What Went Wrong with Vatican II. We'll examine the Pope's efforts to curb dissent and to fully implement the teachings of the Second Vatican Council. Until next time, I'm Raymond Arroyo. See you then.